Today's Great Life made his name on BBC radio and television in a phenomenally successful show, which proved so popular that the BBC received complaints from shopkeepers and publicans protesting that their shops and pubs were empty when it was on. And yet, on the 25th of June 1968, at the age of 44, he took his own life, alone and depressed, in Australia.
Ladies and gentlemen, we present Tony Hancock.
Hancock's half hour.
The British actor and comedian Tony Hancock. And joining me today, nominating Tony Hancock as her great life, is Pam Ayres. Pam's the reason, and I'm not joking, why our betters have decided not to choose the next poet laureate by public ballot. Everybody knows she'd win. Celebrated poet, writer, broadcaster and comic entertainer, Pam was discovered on a TV talent show in 1975. Since then, she's entertained millions with her books, stage shows and radio and TV appearances, and in 2004 was awarded the MBE. Pam, Tony Hancock killed himself nearly a decade before you got into the entertainment business, so you never met him?
No, I never met him, no. But I always felt this tremendous well of affection for him. Initially because of the effect he had on my mother. Because my mother had six children, of whom I'm the youngest. And she didn't laugh very much. You know, she was harassed, busy, hard up. And the effect that the Hancock programmes had on her once we got a TV was extraordinary to me. And the programme that I remember when I first became aware of Tony Hancock was one called The New Nose, where he'd gone to this plastic surgeon and he was going to have a new nose and it looked ridiculous. And he was admiring himself in the mirror and saying, "You handsome devil." And my mother was beside herself. She was doubled up. She couldn't get her breath. And it was so joyful for me to see my mother's reaction. And that was when my admiration and love for Tony Hancock started.
We've got a clip, in fact, from that programme. It's television, so like lots of the clips we're going to have, you just have to imagine how ridiculous the new nose looks. But as you've said, Pam, it wasn't an improvement.
What's the time?
5 to 12.
Come on, let's take it off now.
No. Doctor said the plaster mustn't come off till 12 o'clock.
Look, it won't make any difference. Let me have a look at it.
No!
Just a little peek.
Get off! You break it!
Haven't you got any idea at all what it looks like?
No, I haven't. Sid.
Yes?
I'm frightened. I'm scared, Sid. It's not natural what I've done. Playing with the unknown, it doesn't seem right.
Of course it's right. You're not the first one.
Suppose it's a failure. Suppose it's worse than the other one. I shouldn't have done it. You can't tamper with nature. Vanity, that's what it was. One of the seven deadly sins, vanity. Can't mess about with things beyond our ken. That was the right nose. That was the nose I was supposed to have. There was nothing wrong with it. I've just been a vain fool and I want my old looter back.
All right, you haven't done any wrong. Blimey, you're still the same pure lily-white flower you always have been. 12 o'clock. Stand by, Cinderella for the transformation scene.
Sid, I'm scared. I'm juicing scared.
All right, now take it easy, boy. Nothing to worry about. Here we go.
Is it all right?
Is it all right? It's sensational. What a difference.
You're joking.
Don't touch it. It's a work of art.
Well, give me the mirror then. Let me have a look at it. It's marvellous. I'm handsome, Sid.
Yeah. I'm not kidding you. I never saw such a conk. You'll murder those women now.
Oh, you handsome devil.
Not bad, eh? You'll see who's the master now. Half of me knows, would they? Well, the women of England have had it now.
I can almost hear your mother laughing.
I know, she was helpless.
Also joining us in the studio is our Tony Hancock expert, John Fisher. John's enjoyed a distinguished career as a TV producer and executive, and he's an authority on the history of popular entertainment. His book, Tony Hancock, The Definitive Biography, was published last year. John, that clip, The New Nose, I understand that there's a sort of private story to that that neither Pam Ayres nor her mother nor I are aware of.
Oh, really? Oh, let us in, John. Let us into the secret.
Well, it was Tony's own mother who admitted a little while after that programme was broadcast that the Hancock family all had big noses and were always being teased about them. This had obviously come to the attention of Galton and Simpson, Tony's writers, who were always latching on to things within his own personality, within his own character, to build into comic gold. And this was just one such detail.
He was brilliant, natural, comic, but he depended to some extent on his material, didn't he?
Oh, indeed. And I think that was part of the magic, really, because Galton and Simpson were so brilliant that when they wrote for him, it wasn't as if it was a script that somebody else had written. It was so much him, you know. It was the wonderful blending of the character and the words.
Exactly the
they
question.
They were inseparable, weren't they, John? They were just inseparable, the words and the man.
The three of them were one entity together, and they took many of the things he had said in private conversation, writ them large. I'm absolutely convinced, and this is not to demean arguably the two greatest comic scriptwriters we've ever had, but I think that if that show were being produced today, and given the way that comedy and show business is run, then Tony would be enjoying a third writing credit alongside them.
What I loved so much was that he was so recognisable. All of those traits that he demonstrated, the vanity, the greed, the petty crime, all that. They were sort of us.
They were all of us, yes.
Yeah, they were all of us. That's true.
Yes. Pam, you're someone who performs and entertains under your own name and as yourself. You don't have an alter ego, although I suppose that the stage Pam Ayres isn't entirely the same as the private one. And Hancock, increasingly as the years went on, he was there as Hancock. Do you think it might have been easier for such a troubled man as him, if he'd been able to separate himself from his stage personality?
Quite possibly. You see, I don't presume to compare myself with Tony Hancock, but I don't do an act. I go out onto the stage and I talk to people about what I've written and why I've written it, and I try to make it as funny as possible. I don't do an act. And I think if you can step into a character, that must be easier because you have a shell around you. Mm. You're not revealed as yourself and therefore so vulnerable.
Tell us something, John, about his early life.
He was born in Birmingham in May 1924, and his father was employed in a shipping office. But after 3 years, because of his father's ill health, the family moved down to Bournemouth, where they founded, of all things, a laundry. Unlikely. But his father had a second string because he was a semi-professional entertainer, a comedian, more in the line of, say, Stanley Holloway, performing well-delivered, well-manicured monologues, and totally in love with the stage. So after a short while, they decided, well, they gave up the laundry and they set themselves up in a hotel, which, of course, gave Jack Hancock, his father, the perfect opportunity to play mine host. And because of his theatrical connections, he attracted to the hotel all the great entertainers who were coming into the resort to play in the summer seasons. And amongst these people were the Western brothers and Alcee and Doris Waters, Tommy Hanley, Jack Warner, of course, whom we know as Dixon of Dock Green from later years. And they all befriended the young Tony, who was about 7 or 8 years old at the time, hanging around the bar.
Sort of paradise for a boy with
stage ambitions
of his own.
You know, come along, Sonny.
Yeah.
Come along to the theatre. And they'd stand him in the wings and said, provided you behave yourself, you don't move, you can watch.
Did you get that sort of encouragement yourself, Pam, as a girl?
Oh, no. No, not at all. No, I just felt drawn to the to be a performer. I can't explain it, really. I just wanted to be on the stage, and I thought if I tried hard enough, I could make people laugh, and I seemed to be able to make people laugh. But no, I didn't have any vivid experiences like that.
Hancock started in the RAF. You did too, didn't you?
Yes, I was in the Women's Royal Air Force.
And did you perform?
Yes, I did, yeah. And it was a very, very good environment because every RAF station I went to had a theatre or a folk club or a choir or something where you could get up and have a go.
Hancock found his comedy feat in the RAF. How did that happen, John?
Oh, absolutely. He'd, of course, dabbled as a semi-professional before being called up. But he had the good fortune in the services to secure an audition with the Ralph Reeder Gang Show, which was not the original Scout Gang Show, but something which the RAF had developed out of the original show. And this enabled him to travel and gradually to polish an act. And then, of course, upon his demob, there was no looking back.
What interests me, Pam, is this slight contradiction, in a sense, between a man, an entertainer, whom we know to have been plagued with self-doubt all through his life, had very, very fragile self-esteem, was never sure about his own talent, or so we're led to believe. And yet, if you look at his early life in the RAF and then slowly, slowly building himself a reputation on BBC Radio, you see a really dogged, determined man, absolutely sure that he's going to make it in the end, just plugging and plugging and plugging away until he gets there. It's a strange contrast, isn't it? He can't have been that fragile, or he'd have given up.
No, but the thing about comedy is you can never feel you've done it. Mm. You can never feel that you've actually achieved it and that's it. You can put it on the shelf and there it is. You've got to do it again tomorrow and you've got to do it the day after. And you can come out after some shows and think, that was just the best. Mm. But then you can soon be struck down with doubt if the next night it doesn't go so well. So I think that's the nature of the job, really, that you can never feel that you've actually done it and achieved it. You've got to keep bashing on, and you know, however good you are tonight, sooner or later the rot's going to set in and you're going to start going down the other side.
Hancock really did bash on in the early years with BBC Radio, didn't he, John?
The work rate was phenomenal when you think that once he hit his stride in 1954, over the period of the next 7 years, he recorded something over 160 half hours, either for radio or, much harder, of course, for television.
So it was a relentless work schedule for him, wasn't it?
And don't forget the other thing, Pam, and you must sense this as a performer yourself. Performing comedy, it is the hardest job in the theatrical world. You go out there, there's that automatic litmus test of your success or failure. It's whether they laugh or not.
Yeah.
As you say, die. It's the quintessential word.
And also, you're on your own. That's the thing about a comic. You're on your own. You haven't got an ally. You're not part of a band or a musician with another musician by your side. You're on your own. It's a very, very lonely place, and it can be an immensely thrilling place and uplifting and joyful, but you're on your own.
You
sink or swim by your own wits.
John, his move from radio to television, in retrospect, I guess, was inevitable. Did he always want to end up on TV?
I imagine so, given his skill as a visual comedian. When Hancock moved over, to a lot of there was a lot of scepticism about whether it would work. But then, didn't it work by half and half again?
He had the face, didn't he, John?
Yes.
He had the face. He could portray any emotion, however cunning or devious. He couldn't fail, as far as I could see, on television because of his wonderful, mobile, expressive face.
While things were going so well for him professionally and he's becoming a huge star on television, his private life is not working out at all well, is it, John?
No, his first marriage fell apart with alcohol, I think, as the key catalyst. Tony didn't himself develop a problem with the booze until he really hit the 60s. That's the period after his greatest success. But it had befallen his first wife, Cicely. And inevitably, the self-doubt was setting in. I think the tipping point when things began to unravel for Tony Hancock was the invitation at the end of the 50s to take part in a famous television interview show called Face to Face, where he was to be interviewed by the distinguished journalist John Freeman, a programme which, in previous weeks or months, had interviewed great thinkers of this world, people like Bertrand Russell, great politicians, movers and shakers. They'd never had a popular entertainer before.
Let's just listen to that clip.
The whole of Britain knows you in your professional comic mask, and tonight we want to try and find out what lies behind the mask. Now, are you in the mood to come clean?
Yes, indeed.
You know you're on your own, you're without your scriptwriters.
Yes.
And you'll tell us the truth.
I'll try to.
Do you like talking about yourself or not?
Yes, up to a point, particularly in relation to what I do.
Well, then in
relation
that case,
to comedy, yes.
All right, then I'll ask you, first of all, why are you a comic?
Well, I think I always certainly wanted to be from the first time I can remember. And perhaps looking like this, it was perhaps the only thing I could do. So I turned the sort of deficiencies into a workable thing, if you understand what I mean.
Yes, but let's go a bit deeper than that. Do you think the world is a comic place or is it a tragic place?
Well, I think it consists of the two things. It's both funny and sad, which seem to me to be the two basic ingredients of good comedy.
Basic ingredients. What is being funny? Is it mixing them together? How do you tell?
Well, I think
what
they
is
exist
funny?
Together anyway.
Yes.
By the way we live. When we attempt to be affected or pompous or, how can I say, we are sort of all unsure of ourselves and what we live in. We try to live in a certain way. We try to, we are, I suppose, to a certain extent, all affected. And that is both funny and sad, I think.
So that being funny is showing how people are affected. Is that what you're trying to say?
I think so. I think you expose your own pomposity and other people's and get probably to the real truth of the way you live.
And so that being funny is part of the business of finding out the truth about life.
Entirely.
Yes.
Not to, you can't think of it in any other way.
So why was it so catastrophic for him then? Because I've seen that interview. What did it do that was so destructive, John?
I think it probably made him think he was more of an intellectual than he actually was. Now, Tony Hancock was a very clever, very intelligent man, but he wasn't an intellectual. So if you assume you are and you then apply that to the business of what you do, which is the business of comedy, then could be argued you're on a downward slope.
Did you, at the time, Pam, appreciating him as a comedian, did you know about this darker side of his life, the mood swings, the private despair and
no,
all that?
I didn't know anything about that. He was just a heroic, lovable figure to me who brought great gales of laughter into our home. That was why I loved him. I didn't know anything about him. And it was years afterwards, you know, when I heard of his death that that I began to think about him more and hear things about him that made me sad, that I thought perhaps he hadn't realised how much people loved him, and but I wished I could have told him.
You see, you talk about mood swings. I think they only really fully developed with the alcoholism. Tony himself, one of the joys of my research was to discover what a hail fellow well-met type of guy he could be. I never met one single person or read one single person, with one possible exception, who came across him, who worked with him, who ended up disliking him. They were all cheering him right to the end,
well,
the exception being Kenneth Williams, who was a whole different kind of beast himself,
well,
anyhow.
Who would about a lot of people, wasn't he?
But Tony used to say, you know, going back to the 50s, if I give the impression of being morose, it is only because I am so deeply absorbed in my work. And once I concentrate on the job in hand, I am lost to the world. Now, that can give somebody who doesn't fully understand him a different impression. And it comes down to the perfectionist in him. The man who used to say, I'd work at an inflection as if I were writing a sonnet. I worried about every word. You know about that, Pam.
Well, I do. I know that strikes a chord with me because I know what it is to be so frightened, you know, at the beginning of a tour or when I've played the great venues of the world that I've been lucky enough to play. I've played Sydney Opera House and you know you've got to go out in front of 2,000, 2,500 people on your own with what you have written. And it's a feeling of utter dread. And my husband leaves me well alone. He knows that I've got nothing to say to him because I'm sort of somewhere else. And I'm not comparing myself with Hancock, because I wouldn't be arrogant enough to do that, but I know that feeling where you just close yourself away and wait for the hours to pass till you've done it and you hope you made a good job and you come out the other side.
This is BBC Radio 4. I'm Matthew Paris and you're listening to Great Lives. Today's subject is Tony Hancock, chosen by Pam Ayres. And also here in the studio, we have the biographer, John Fisher. He was becoming increasingly difficult professionally within the corporation, wasn't he?
He was ill, wasn't he? He was ill.
Yes. I don't think that during his work for the BBC he became more difficult to work with professionally. On the penultimate show he made for the corporation in the series he did without Sid James, it was called simply Hancock. That show, incidentally, that penultimate show was The Blood Donor. In advance of that, he had been involved in a road accident which had impaired his learning capacity, with the result that on that episode he relied very heavily on cue cards and autocue machines. And that provided a bit of the beginning of the rot, as it were, because he discovered in that he didn't necessarily have to learn his lines. Mm. So when he subsequently went to work for ITV, yes, learning the lines wasn't as high on the agenda. He did try. But when you know that you can probably get by only delivering 90% of what you've been learning at a level of 100%, you also discover you can take a drink before the recording, as well as what he'd only restricted himself to after the recording.
And then Australia, which, as you say, Pam, you've toured Australia too.
If
you feel you're failing, Australia must be a very hard...
Well, I have toured often in Australia, and it's arduous. It's a vast country. You have to travel enormous distances. And I get very homesick. I love Australia, and I love the Australian audiences, but I get so homesick.
But you've never considered ending it all?
No, I can't say I did. No, well, but then I had my husband and a sound marriage. You know, if your home life was falling apart and you had no children to give you that consistent affection and that great levelling effect they have on you, then you have only your job by which to judge yourself. If you've got children, they love you no matter what. You go home and they cuddle you and give you a kiss and you matter to somebody. But if you haven't got that, then you've only got the job and how well the audience just received you.
And Tony Hancock, John, had just separated from, split up from his second wife, hadn't he?
Yeah. He went out to Australia knowing this was his last chance. It just feasibly might have come together for him. But my feeling, and I tried to articulate this as best I can in the book, was that there came a realization that at the point when things seemed to be picking up, the series actually he was recording out there was beginning to settle down. His second marriage, the divorce, had been announced. That pleased him, in fact. He'd been on the wagon for 3 or 4 months, miraculously, but at this point he realised that the potential solution to his own happiness, which was that he might get together again with his first wife, Cicely, with whom he'd never fallen out of love, that was not going to be. It wasn't going to be as straightforward as he'd imagined it. And we know what happened. He took the overdose and... that was the end.
What would you say his legacy as a comedian is, John?
Dennis Norden, I think, summed up Hancock's legacy when he coined the phrase, the echo of remembered laughter. And what he meant by that is that it is impossible for a member of his audience to realise, for example, that they've forgotten to cancel the newspapers while they've been on holiday, to endure the agonies of the common cold, to be bored senseless on a Sunday afternoon, to get stuck in a lift, to donate blood without enjoying again the bonus of the remembered laughter that all those memories trigger.
We never called him Tony Hancock. It was old Hancock. Or yes, it was, wasn't it? Old Hancock, yeah, my mother would say. Old Hancock.
Does he stand the test of time, do you think?
Well, because I've been delighted to be asked to do this programme and talk about him, I've been watching lots of his television programmes on CD, and my husband and I have laughed out loud. So I would have to say yes. And on a personal note, the thing that's struck me recently is that for some reason in my 62nd year, I am doing very well in my shows, and I'm playing bigger and bigger audiences and bigger venues, and it's going extremely well. And one of the stories I tell is about my dad's old swimming costume that my mum knitted for him, and how he used to go in the sea at Weymouth and come out clutching the gusset because the thing would drop. And it's a very popular story. And at the end of it, one day, a lady came up to me and she looked so happy, and she had her mum with her. And her mother bought a book and I signed the book, and then her mother went off to do something else. And the lady said to me, "I have never seen my mother laugh like that ever." And that's what I'd like to say to Tony Hancock.
Let's then finally listen to a clip from one of the sketches that we were talking about earlier on. Something I remember as a boy laughing out loud myself with my family, living in southern Rhodesia, of all places, to which television had just then come. Tony Hancock in The Blood Donor.
That's just a smear. It may be just a smear to you, mate, but it's life and death to some poor men. I've just taken a sample to test.
A sample? How much do you want, then?
Well, a pint, of course.
A pint? Have you gone raving mad?
You must be joking. A pint is a perfectly normal quantity to take.
You don't seriously expect me to believe that? I mean, I came in here in all good faith to help me country. I don't mind giving a reasonable amount, but a pint? That's very nearly an armful.
Tony Hancock. You've been listening to Great Lives. My thanks to my guest, Pam Ayres, who chose Hancock, and our expert, his biographer, John Fisher. Goodbye.